prepare for something like this?
You were able to determine the probability that this massive earthquake could strike the Cascadia Fault Zone by establishing the pattern of massive quakes on this fault, and you determined that there was one, and scientists determined that there was one, magnitude 9, in 1700. Are you able to determine when the next one will be?
Well, no. We can't. That's something we can't do. But what we can do, the best thing we can do, really, is look further into the past and look at the patterns over time. So what I do is called paleoseismology, the same thing that that Brian did in Willapa Bay. And the farther back in time we can go, the better our forecast, and this is forecast, not prediction. So in the work I do, we work offshore looking at submarine landslides that were triggered by earthquakes. And that record goes back roughly 10,000 years, a little different in different places. But so we have a rich data set, and we can go back and just calculate the probabilities of the fault failing from actual data without relying on a model or really any assumptions at all. And that's where the 1 in 3 number comes from. And so that's a 1 in 3 chance in the next 50 years that we'll have anything bigger than an 8 anywhere in Cascadia, and based on the 10,000-year record.
So a 1 in 3 chance that you'll have a massive earthquake in the next 50 years, you said?
Right. And that really pushes it into territory where this might actually happen in our lifetimes, and there's a good probability that it will. And that sort of really kicked the thinking about this into a different gear altogether.
Chris Goldfinger, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Chris Goldfinger is a marine geologist, geophysicist, and paleoseismologist at Oregon State University. Well, what he had to say is certainly sobering, and I'm saying that here in California, which after all is riven with faults. But there's no doubt about it. There are still secrets under the ocean. Water is, after all, it's just a great cloak. Sunlight doesn't get down there. There's suspended material in the water, so even if you go down underneath with lights, you don't see far. And radar and radio, they just don't work underwater. It reminds me of what Carl Sagan said in a different context years ago. Somewhere, something is waiting to be known. Well, that somewhere is probably under the surface of the ocean.
Thanks to the deep thinkers who helped produce this show, Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also, thanks to financial support from Rena Scholsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to what lies beneath. If you'd like to hear more Big Picture Science, you'll find more. The episodes are in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio, despite the fact that radio waves don't penetrate the ocean water very far, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show.
And do you have a comment, a criticism, or a suggestion? Well, toss in some faint praise and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
This is WHFR Dearborn. You are listening to The Magic of Radio.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. One of the cornerstone cases of ufology is the 1953 Kinchlow Air Force Base UFO case at Kinross, Michigan, in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where the plane and pilot that were scrambled to intercept the bogey disappeared and have never been found to this day. Bill Murphy is a Michigan resident who has thoroughly studied this case, as well as many other well-documented cases. Bill is a board member of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. He is a former state director of the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. He currently writes for the Anomalous.com. That's a website which reports and comments on the better current online articles in the field of anomalous science. Bill holds a bachelor's and master's degree from Michigan State University in history, and did further postgraduate work in that field at the University of Michigan. He taught college courses in world civilization, archaeology, and Egyptology for 17 years, and worked for 35 years in the automotive industry. Bill has presented on the UFO topic in numerous states over the years, and we are pleased to have him on the line with us. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. I'm really glad to be here.
I appreciate you coming on. Now, given your background in academia, what spurred your interest in the UFO phenomenon?
I think that I always had an interest, and I read, actually, you know, Chariots of the Gods and Captain Ruppelt's book on the Air Force program to study UFOs. Hmm. But it actually happened that while I was teaching community college, I had a student from Mason, Michigan, in the center of the Lower Peninsula, who was their local X-Files cop for the Mason Sheriff's Department.
Okay.
And this gentleman told me about an organization that, at the time I thought, he said Muffin, that investigated unusual UFO cases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after about a year of thinking about that, because it sounded interesting but a little odd, myself and my wife went to a, as it turned out, MUFON state meeting, and found out that while the subject was rather strange, the people were discussing it in a very rational way. Hmm. And that led to further interest, and I ended up becoming a local state section director and then eventually state director. And with a bunch of the other Michigan MUFON people, we put on the 97 Symposium in Grand Rapids. And so from that time on, I've maintained an interest in the field.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people have this idea that MUFON has a bunch of these woo-woo people in tinfoil hats and what have you, you know. And
but, you're exactly right. Yeah. And I confess that I was one of those that was a little bit
leery.
You know, hesitant. It did take me a whole year to kind of get up the courage to go to a meeting, but... you know, as with so much else, it opened my eyes to, you know, a vast, really uncharted kind of subject, and one that was extremely interesting. It can be studied in a wide variety of ways, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun, plus it may be a very important subject as well.
Right, that's right. Now, when we say cornerstone cases, we're talking about what, well-documented cases? And
yeah, I think it has to have a couple main components to it.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the case must be truly unusual. The reports, the technology, the events described must be sufficiently different from the norm that they really stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And the second very important qualification is that there has to be a coherence to the various reports. In other words, this isn't just a bunch of different stories that kind of relate to each other, told by a variety of people who sometimes aren't even well described. You can't get back to them to pick up the details. And it has other qualities about the sighting or the event being something that usually is quite close, or it might be supported by radar. Very important if it can be multiple witnesses who have not any contact with each other prior to making the report. So it's basically a measure of the outstanding weirdness of the case, plus the confidence you have that what is being reported by the witness is what that witness actually experienced.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so walk our listeners through, if you would please, the Kinross UFO incident.
Okay, there's a lot of details to it, and I can always give you some of the background sources, but it basically happens that on the night of November the 23rd, 1953, an unidentified object was seen approaching the Sioux Locks on the eastern edge of Lake Superior, coming towards U.S. airspace, and so an F-89C Scorpion interceptor was scrambled from, at that time, Kinross Army Auxiliary Airfield and sent after this thing. There were two people. The pilot was First Lieutenant Felix Monclaw, Jr., and the radar observer was Robert R. Wilson. A lot of accounts mess up his name, but it was Robert L. Wilson. I did myself. I've been influenced by that. Monclaw was from Louisiana, which becomes actually fairly important later on. And the interceptor basically was sent on a northwest heading out across Whitefish Bay. It went up to 30,000 feet. Around 6:41, so we're talking about 19 minutes after takeoff, the control of the interceptor was turned over to a radar station at Keweenaw Point, actually a little south of the point itself, but 23 miles north of Calumet in the western Upper Peninsula. There was, throughout much of this period, a lot of radio contact problems, and so the Calumet station, which wasn't completely, perfectly in contact with the Scorpion, took over. At 6:47, the radar station vectored officers Monclaw and Wilson to make a turn due west. Then around 6:51, a starboard turn to 20 degrees east-northeast, and to descend towards 7,000 feet, which was the altitude of the bogey. Mm-hmm. And at this point, around 6:51, the interceptor was about 10 miles from the object. It was coming up from above and behind, which was the standard procedure for intercept. At about 6:52, there was the last radio contact between the ground control station and the interceptor. And then at 6:55, the two radar blips on the screen of the Calumet station merged and then vanished. And basically, that was the last that was certainly heard or known of two men. And so at the very beginning, this is a very serious, tragic incident.
Right.
And one that the officers, of course, deserve our respect.
Yeah, now when you say these two blips merged, did it appear that one was going, that the plane, our a U.S. plane was going under or over the object or into
the
object?
Well, that's a very good question. They actually, the Blitz merged. They didn't at that time know whether they had actually come in contact, whether one blip was above the other. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that figured in some of the stories that were told to Monclaw's widow a little bit later on. And one of them, they said that the interceptor flew too low below the UFO and crashed into the lake. And that's something that Kevin Randall and other people that know the procedure say no interceptor flies below a plane that it's intercepting, if you will, that it's rendezvousing with. But it's also possible that the images, there was this very close proximity, and then at that moment, the images, the radar returns, it might have gone below the level of the radar at that time due to the curvature of the Earth. It wasn't able to perhaps go below 7,000 feet at that particular time. Mm. So they really didn't know. There was also talk in some of the official explanations that the image that merged with the plane was actually a phantom radar echo of the plane itself. Mm. Now, obviously, first off, there was no phantom echo in the beginning when the plane was scrambled. So this explanation that some debunkers have used is a little tenuous in that particular regard. But in any event, they did seem to merge. They did seem to go off screen. There are versions that for a moment or a little while, the merge blip continued on almost as if nothing had happened in the same direction, but then it did vanish even with that particular story.
Mm.
Almost immediately, the Air Force responded very soon after the Canadian government became involved because the apparent rendezvous and crash site, if it occurred near that place, was in Canadian waters. 5-day search was conducted. Nothing was found. Basically, after the 5 days, they had to quit. But the story, of course, doesn't end there. In fact, the next year, they did another search based on some new information that perhaps the plane had been aloft longer than the last radar contact of 6:55.
Hmm.
During the search, there was surface, there was air, there were ground searches conducted, and nothing came up. But one of the initial air crews sent, again out of Kinross, to see if they could locate the F-89C Scorpion, which was, I think, called the Avenger Red. I think it was Avenger Black, but my memory may be incorrect on this. But another F-89C with Bill Mingenbach aboard and crew, his radar guy, heard something, a 5-second transmission, and couldn't make the words out very well. It was kind of in the middle of apparently a sentence. It seemed to sound like, "I think we had better." And this was well after the plane had vanished. And I believe, in fact, it was even beyond the amount of fuel that the plane would have had. The thing about this transmission was it was in the Louisiana drawl that Monclaw had.
Hmm.
And so there was a further element of mystery added to this story. As it was, crews at the airbase itself or the airfield itself and also at Selfridge Air Force Base were said to have figured that somehow the UFO had swallowed up the F-89C.
Hmm. And they never did find any any wreckage of that plane, right?
Nothing that could be completely identified. Mm-hmm. And this becomes, in fact, part of the continuing story, because there was a noise heard by some railway workers. I think it was by a place called Lemur, Ontario,
mm-hmm.
Somewhat inside the province of Ontario, that sounded like a plane coming down low and then crashing. And that stimulated some people. In fact, I think it was Monclaw's father and a few others of the family members to ask for another search. And as it turned out, again, that turned up nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was also another element to this. In 1968, there was some military plane wreckage found by a couple prospectors near Alona Bay, Ontario. And the wreckage was identified initially as being military because it was of the type that would be needed for military-type maneuvers. It was literally a stronger structure. Was never specifically identified as belonging to the plane.
Mm.
And oddly enough, the wreckage apparently vanished a little bit later on.
It vanished.
That was another unusual element.
I guess.
There was a further thing, and the MUFON International UFO Journal
mm-hmm.
Does a good job of describing this and the investigation that MUFON conducted on it in 2005 and 2006. There was a company that was apparently geared towards studying and retrieving wrecks in the waters of Lake Superior, Great Lakes Diving Company. And this particular company claimed towards the end of 2005 that in one of their activities, they discovered what they ultimately identified as the wreckage of an F-89 plane on the bottom of Lake Superior, with indications that a wing had been sheared off, with an intact cockpit, and then also something around 200 feet away, another type of wreckage that seemed to come from something else. And as I remember, there was some talk, there were some reason to believe there were markings on that wreckage indicating that it had collided with something. And of course, therefore, the supposition was the plane had been discovered, whatever it hit or hit it,
right,
was found, and of course that brought to mind all sorts of things about literally what some people had suspected, that it had been a UFO and military jet collision, and that maybe now the mystery of the ages would be solved.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to recovering, hopefully, the bodies of the lost crew. That story about the Great Lakes Dive Company and Adam Jimenez has its own legs. It's a story within a story, if you will. But the MUFON folks did some investigating and basically found that the Great Lakes Dive Company seemed not to have a very real basis, that the story itself literally was a latter-day hoax, and that, in fact, again, we lost the ability to find out exactly what happened in this particular case. You have radar. You have different radars locked onto this. The plane itself, the interceptor itself, did get radar contact with this object. And subsequent claims to the contrary by the Air Force notwithstanding, this is a genuine mystery today.
I guess. I need to take one moment to, just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with UFO researcher, Mr. Bill Murphy. And, Bill, we were talking about the Kinchlow Air Force Base. How many, there's a couple of things I jotted down notes here while you were talking. How many radar installations were there? In other words, these two blips merging, how many different radars picked that up and recorded that?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I was doing some background study for this. I think initially there was one at or near Kinross. Calumet had picked it up. Of course, the interceptor itself had picked it up. There are claims, as sometimes accrete around these stories. People come up with elements that that had not been mentioned before. Whether they are accurate or not, that there was a radar in the lower peninsula. And I don't believe it was necessarily that it was Selfridge, but they may have had it as well. But there was basically, I think, an understanding that it was multiple radars. I think that there were several different bands involved, not particularly sure on this, but this was a multiple radar situation. And so that was, you know, what this did, though, was it actually made waves for the Air Force because they had to explain this. And in an echo of Roswell, not that long before, the Air Force came out with subsidiary explanations as the first one didn't make sense, or was in particular in the first case something the Air Force didn't want to admit, because the initial report, and this was printed in the Chicago Tribune, as I recall, was that the plane was lost during an intercept of an unknown object. The Air Force quashed that very quickly. They came up with the idea that they explain it as intercepting a Canadian civilian DC-3, ended up apparently talking, I think Frank Edwards talked to some of those pilots, and they had no idea they were being intercepted. Then the next explanation was that it was a Canadian Air Force C-47 Dakota, which is the military version, Canadian military version of the DC-3. But as opposed to civilian, it was a military flight that was 30 miles off course on a run from Winnipeg, Manitoba, to Sudbury, Ontario. Well, subsequently, the pilot of that C-47 was contacted, and he had no idea that he was being intercepted, and basically indicated that that was an impossibility. Plus, there were a couple of communications to investigators from the Canadian government, Royal Canadian Air Force, and then I think it was also a Department of Transportation, that they had no record of any of their aircraft being intercepted. There's some interpretation, as well as possibly some of the directions that were given not being accurate, and some people say that that was to confuse investigators, because the Air Force did not track this or billet this as a UFO case. They said this was simply, you know, some kind of air kind of incident. And in fact, they said that Monclaw suffered vertigo during this thing and basically plunged the plane into the drink on his own.
Yeah, well, that would...
He was known to have suffered from vertigo, but everybody that seems to have been knowable about this particular incident, said he would have been on instruments mm-hmm. at this time, and Vertigo would not have come into this. The Air Force sent two, according to Donald Kehoe, and apparently it's backed up by other sources, two different delegations to Monclaw's widow. And the first one told her that basically the Vertigo story,
mm-hmm.
As the plane was also under the vehicle it was intercepting, and the combination of low altitude and vertigo and maybe focus on the bogey put the two-seater plane into the water.
Mm-hmm.
When the second delegation came, Monclaw's widow had thought about this for a moment. She said, well, if the plane basically just ditched without the pilot obviously knowing he was doing that, there should be a body.
Yeah.
So she asked about, you know, when are you working to find the body? Will it ever be found? She was told, no, the plane exploded at high altitude, and so there would be no body.
There would still be wreckage.
There should still be wreckage, but you know, the thing that immediately excited Donald Kehoe was the fact that there were two different stories that mm-hmm. were given the widow, just like three different variants of the story of the intercept. And with the Canadian, two aspects of the Canadian government contradicting what the U.S. position was on this.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. You would think there should have been life jackets at the very least that would have been buoyant. But again, nothing was found.
And with the sonar that we have today, even though this dive company proved out to be a hoax, with the sonar we have today, my goodness, we found the Titanic at, mm-hmm. you know, 2 miles down in the ocean, and we can't find the wreckage of a plane in Lake Superior? Excuse me?
Yeah.
You know?
It is a big lake. It's a deep lake. You don't know how much wreckage there was and whether it could have been silted over, but...
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right in being a little hesitant to accept that at absolute face value.
Yeah, and that...
the story itself, you know, with the different explanations and some of the you know, evidence that really the Air Force didn't want to discuss this.
Well, no.
makes it remain mysterious.
Yeah. And then this this excuse, it was a blip. The blip was the echo of the plane that was chasing it.
Yeah, phantom echo.
Yeah, well, why would the plane wouldn't have left the base to go up and chase its own echo. You know what I'm saying? What?
And see, that's...
I see my echo up there. I'm going to go chase it. What?
Yeah. Yes.
That's making no sense.
Yeah, it's as is with a lot of the, let's say, the debunking explanations, there are key elements, key facts, about which there is no dispute, that are not comprehended in the explanation, that basically invalidate
right.
the explanation given.
Right. You would think... That you know, it's a case of Roswell and this echo explanation and many other explanations that the debunkers give. You'd think that they would run it by somebody. Does this sound logical to you? You know.
Yeah.
And
there's unfortunately, I think there's a lot of that that you can see in the Air Force treatment of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as you know, that some of the people that I work with put out a book called UFOs and Government,
mm-hmm.
A Historical Inquiry in 2012. And the picture they paint using the government's own information, primary sources, the government cannot deny their existence, shows that there was this, actually particularly since January of 1953, there was a fix, in effect, to lower the temperature of the public on UFOs. And the interesting thing was that this fix, this directive from the Robertson panel, which was CIA funded, wasn't implemented always consistently. It was so much that this was kind of a low key thing, but just people were discouraged from getting the public excited about UFOs. Now, ostensibly, the reason for all of that was that UFOs and UFO groups got people worried. UFO flaps, such as the one in July of 1952 over Washington, D.C., could cause communications channels to be jammed. Same thing happened with the swamp gas sightings of 1966. And the CIA was concerned that that kind of excitement and communication bollocksing up could mask an enemy attack, or it could be simply a kind of psyops operation by an enemy. And so those kinds of reasons were behind the basically Project Blue Book itself becoming a sham, and window dressing for public consumption. While, you know, it's just absolutely incomprehensible that there wasn't another group studying some of these serious cases seriously because of the kinds of aerobatic maneuvers and speeds attained by the objects that our planes were chasing, obviously having a great deal of military implications, and some, as some people within the service felt, literally out-of-this-world connotations.
Yeah, so shoot them down. Shoot them down.
Well, you know, there was that that order was given a couple times. We, fortunately, seem to have gotten over that mostly, although I know there's some very good books. Keith Chester's got a good book on aerial UFO encounters. I think Frank Fischino has a book of that same name, Shoot
Him
Down.
Right, right, right.
We have some reason to believe through Paul Stonehill that the Soviets engaged in Shoot Him Down for a little bit longer than we did, and that none of the events in which a Soviet plane and a UFO came into contact worked out at all well for the humans involved.
No. That's why we stopped it, because we lost too many pilots trying to shoot them down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm going to take one more moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with UFO researcher, Mr. Bill Murphy. And we're talking about so-called cornerstone cases in ufology, where there are multiple witnesses, there are multiple radar confirmation, and multiple excuses given by the Air Force and the powers that be, none of which fit the evidence, none of which make any sense whatsoever. And, you know, if they did, I'd be the first to admit it, because investigating these UFO cases, the first thing we do is try to rule out any prosaic explanation. And if whatever's left must be the, you know, must be the explanation, as Sherlock Holmes would say.
I think that's a very good point, because we start with the null hypothesis. We assume that there's nothing unusual about a particular event unless there is sufficient evidence, again, both in terms of how strange it is and how well documented it is, that we have to reorder our understanding of that event. A debunker will start out with the exact opposite, that this can't be anything unusual. And so, therefore, you have to explain it. You have to prove something a little bit differently. A skeptic, a good skeptic, and there are those, will start out with the same premise as we do, that the event is explicable through normal means, but their level of proof required may be a little bit more stringent than those that are a little bit more involved in the field and have a little more experience in understanding what can and cannot be in terms of the physics and other elements involved in the case.
Right. Now, who was it that said exceptional claims require exceptional proof?
I think Sagan said that.
Yeah, Carl Sagan.
And it is true.
Yeah.
And we try to hold ourselves to that standard. And once we do have what we call strong enough evidence to consider something a, quote, UFO, that does not mean that we know it has the Vulcan High Command insignia on it or anything like that.
Right.
It simply means that now this falls into an area of cases where we can look for patterns. We can look for trends.
Right.
We can look to try to characterize the different kinds of reports and what is involved. And that's where the real value to this goes. Without that, we wouldn't have figured out that the Hestelin lights in Scandinavia are apparently a natural event. People were too ready to dismiss that as being just maybe the product of too much Swedish alcohol or something like that.
Right.
But there was a dedicated group of people that finally got some good instruments on these lights that were coursing around in Norway and Sweden, and they found something that we would not have known. Finding a UFO and determining something's a UFO can be a way to knowledge about our world as well as the universe.
That's right. That's right. And so many people, you know, there's so much evidence out there to look at. Like you say, we're liable to find out, you know, there's something very prosaic. We just didn't know about it.
Right, but we have to have eyes to see and a mind that's willing to entertain several possibilities as we go through this process.
And then when you have a debunker come out and give explanation like, the blip was an echo of the plane that hadn't yet left the ground. You know, that's an exceptional explanation. Where's your exceptional proof? And, well, we don't have to give any exceptional proof. So.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, these cases are complicated enough so I think some people figure, well, if we just throw this thing in, okay, we've done our duty,
right.
And people won't question it because they won't start putting two and two together and saying that does not equal four anymore. You're telling me something that does not make sense.
Another one that I like is, that was proven to have been a hoax, or that was proven to have been an airplane. Okay, who proved it and what was their proof? Well, I don't know.
Absolutely.
I heard it. I saw it on the internet, and if it's on the internet, it must be true. So.
Yeah. And again, it's I see this. I actually see it on both sides. I looked at something overnight, and it's in the Anomalous today, where a very interesting video, photograph, was offered as evidence that UFOs were concerned with earthquakes in Italy. It was credited to a particular guy, and there was a little bit of a backstory there, but it turns out that the gentleman that it was credited to is a tremendously creative Photoshop person with a great PixArt site. And it looks to me like somebody took one of those images that he had put together and then came up with the story that this was just seen a couple days ago and then made a story of it. We encounter that, and the problem is that there can be one thing like that where we're taken up by a hoax, or we come up with, we fail to make the proper analysis and solve a case that really is soluble. If that happens, we get really banged for it. But the other people, officialdom, can say, right, that was proven to be a hoax.
Right.
And people seem to let it slide.
Right. So who's hoaxing whom, right?
Exactly.
Right. So there's another so-called cornerstone case, and that's the coin helicopter incident of 1973. Tell us about that one.
Well, this is a case that Dr. Michael Swords, who's, I believe, the greatest living ufologist, says is the second best case ever.
Hmm.
This is a story where a crew, four-man crew, of a helicopter on a flight returning to Cleveland from Columbus on the night of October 18th, 1973, around 11 o'clock, encountered something that basically seems to have paralleled their course northeast for a while, then come at them at a speed they estimated in excess of 600 knots, dead stopped right in front of them and above them without any perturbation, any wind, or even any noise, bathed them in a green beam. It also had a red light and a white light. Bathed them in a green beam and took off to the west. Now, while this thing was approaching, the crew, that would be Captain Lawrence Coyne, his co-pilot, Rick Jetsey, and Staff Sergeant John Healy and Sergeant Robert Yanisek, their vehicle, they tried to engage in some evasive maneuvers, basically getting down low as quick as they could and getting pretty close, actually, to ground level. And as this thing hovered in front of them, whether it was the green beam itself or something accompanied it, it apparently lifted the helicopter up 1,000 feet or more.
Hmm.
Without the crew becoming aware of any acceleration or any noise from strains on the part of the structure of the helicopter, they didn't realize that while their collective and the yoke to basically get the helicopter down as fast as it could, I think at the end Coyne was trying to go 2,000 feet per minute. That was still down. The helicopter should have been still descending, but the last altitude they noticed was 1,700 feet. When they finally realized what had happened, the altimeter now read 3,500 feet, and that they were climbing 1,000 feet per minute, although, again, the collective was still in the full down position. So they got control of the helicopter, had no idea but what was going on, but apparently this was a real good CE-2 with a UFO helicopter interaction.
CE-2, explain it.
Yeah, a close encounter of the second kind. So that's an object or UFO, we'll say, sighted within about 500 feet of an observer, close enough to make structural details out, and something that leaves some kind of effect. It can be a ground trace, it can be radiation burns, it can be evidence that, in this case, a craft is lifted, but some kind of palpable physical evidence on the part of the UFO on the witnesses.
Okay. So it lifted it up, and then dropped it?
Well, lifted it up and continued on its way. In fact, after the UFO headed west, further west, and Coyne realized what was going on, he brought the controls back to a stable position. And in that time, the helicopter had risen another 300 feet. So now it was around 3,800 feet. Had been cruising at 90 knots at 2,500 feet. Did the evasive maneuvers, was down to at least 1,700 feet, probably a lot farther down. Then was lifted up to 3,500, and it was 3,800 feet before they could gain full control of the craft. Mm. Now, that was interesting in itself, because these were all trained observers. They had a very close encounter. There was a disruption of contact with Mansfield Airport. When this thing started heading towards them, the Coyne asked Mansfield if there was any evidence, if there are any jets out there from the Ohio Air National Guard, and they weren't able to answer because the communication was disrupted. Hmm. So that may have been another effect. But these gentlemen did turn in a report, something they had seen very close. They were certain it was metallic. One of the guys, Jetsy, was in the left-hand front seat, co-pilot seat. He originally had been driving the ship, as it were, when Coyne took over the controls and did the evasive procedure. Mm. But Jetsy only saw a white light, which was the UFO basically vanishing to the west. So that was, you know, very good witnesses, trained people. They apparently did everything they were supposed to do in terms of evasive maneuvers, contrary to what some debunkers said. Mm. But there were also witnesses on the ground. And so this case becomes even more important in terms of evidence, because there was a family, well, a mother, her children, and a niece, I think it was, that were traveling in the same area. They had seen, as they were heading south from Mansfield, Ohio, they were west of the site eventually of the helicopter rendezvous, they had seen a red light traveling south. I did not mention that before this red light from the east approached the helicopter, Sergeant Healy on the left rear seat had seen a red light going north to south to his west. This may very well have been the light that this family saw. They made a turn towards the east and ultimately saw the UFO and the helicopter in close proximity. Hmm. And from their description, it does appear that the UFO stopped in front of and or above the helicopter and actually pulled it a little bit to the northeast before it let it go, and as it apparently also pulled it upwards. Hmm. So there was corroborative evidence from that particular family. Also, there was a woman that John Timmerman from the Center for UFO Studies interviewed later on. Jean Elias. She was watching TV at the time, half sleeping. Her 14-year-old son was sleeping in the next room, and there was a tremendous helicopter thump, thump, thump coming. Mm-hmm. So much so that they were pretty scared there was going to be a collision. And they were too scared to go out and look, but the boy's bedroom was bathed in a green light.
Wow.
The family that got outside their car, that was the DeLong family, saw a green field apparently bathing them and their car, turning it to look like it was green. There are other subsequent reports of people who believe they saw these events, but in some cases the timing is off. But these were two solid. In one case, there was visual. In the other case, there was this extremely unusual sound, which does provide some corroboration.
Was there radar, any radar confirmation?
There was no radar confirmation that I know of. Okay. As I recall, they weren't, they were just following the road as it was going north, and I don't think that the Huey was under radar control at the time.
And what was the official explanation by the powers that be?
Well, I think the Air Force was pretty coy on this one. We do know that the debunkers had a real problem. Class in particular was troubled by this. The debunking explanation was that the crew just had a massive error in perception.
Oh, my.
Hear that one out. And the same, of course, affected the ground witnesses. And really what they were seeing was a meteor that was coming in red and then turned green. Now, the sighting, Jenny Zeidman, who did the key study on this, called a helicopter UFO encounter over Ohio, she figures now that the sighting lasted a good 6 minutes in the case of the helicopter crew.
Mm-hmm.
We know that meteors don't take that long to do their job before
think so.
They impact.
No, I don't think so. Meteorite would impact, but
well, a meteorite would be the result of the meteor, hitting something, and so this is one that there are no good explanations.
That was
the only explanation is that this is something that is unknown, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But Coyne, in particular, the pilot, the head of the crew, felt so strongly about this that he was one of many people that testified before the UN to try to get the UN to get a formal UFO study going. This was something that a very level-headed crew, that you can see some videos on this. These people were not given to making things up, and yet they had an encounter with the extraordinary.
Right. So I was going to say that would be one slow meteor, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. in a lot of these cases, the debunking explanation, and there was one of these in the Condon report. You have to posit something that, if it's natural, is so extraordinary that it has occurred once in recorded history and probably won't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're running really low on time. I wanted to touch on the 1978 New Zealand case, but we got like 3 minutes, so can we do something with that in 3 minutes?
Well, you know, basically that's an interesting case that has had a lot of recent information on it. 20-year-old gentleman by the name of Frederick Valentich took a trip from Moorabbin Airport in southern Australia towards King Island, which is an island north of Tasmania, and never went there, never got there. During the flight, he came upon something that he felt was dogging him. This would have been around a little after 7 o'clock at night, so we're talking about October. I want to say October 21st of 1978. Mm. That's correct. He's flying under 5,000 feet, so he wasn't under radar control. Something seemed to toy with him, and he a couple times said, "It's not an aircraft," and then his microphone went dead, and he was no longer seen or heard from since. There was some wreckage whose identification numbers, it was a cowl for his Cessna plane, was discovered much later. The numbers on that call fall within the range of his plane, but it isn't an absolute certain match. It's had some people claim to be witnesses, but a whole bunch of information was finally released in 2012 by the Australian government files on the case. You can look it up. I think about 500 pages of stuff. At the time, of course, people thought he'd been swallowed by a UFO. The Australian government poo-pooed that idea, and a lot of the subsequent people getting involved in it. And we do know that Valentich did some odd things before the actual flight that have called into question whether he even, in fact, was planning on it being a one-way flight or trying to take off with the aircraft.
Really?
But that's not fair to the guy's memory to hold that as a, you know, as an explanation until we know a little bit more about the case.
Right.
But it's a story in itself. It's fascinating.
So possibly that one, but I would say pretty much definitely the Kinchlow case, the Kinross.
Kinchlow and Coyne, and we know something, as you well know, about Holland Grand Haven in 94.
Right.
There is too much evidence there to toss that off as hoax or, you know, misidentification of something mundane.
There are a lot of what we could call cornerstone cases that maybe another time we'll get together and discuss them. What do you think?
I'll look forward to it, Dave.
Okay. And where can people go to find out more about your work?
Well, they can go to The Anomalist, that's anomalist.com. I and several other people write for that online publication, and basically we keep you up to speed on some of the better information in the field of anomalies in general.
Some of the weird stuff that's going on in this world, huh?
You've got it, and there happens to be a lot of it.
Don't I know it?
Yes.
Mr. Bill Murphy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Well, I hope very much we can, Dave, and it's always a pleasure working with you, sir.
As it is with you, sir. So, thanks again, and have a good one.
Yourself as well. Take care.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. That's UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves.